Hi.
Hello, Chaney.
How are you, Bailey?
I'm doing okay. How are you?
Oh, I'm peachy keen, Jelly Bean. Thanks for asking.
Well, welcome back to Two Sisters Present
America's Sweethearts.
I'm Bailey.
I'm Chaney.
And this is a podcast that focuses on women in film through their catalog of work, and we look at it by genre.
This was a journey. This last film that we watched went... You know, when you sent me the name of this movie, you did what I read, which was Windows. You sent me Windows. And when I was looking at her film credits, I read Windows when I saw it. And then when I saw that you wrote Windows, that's what I typed in to find it. And I could not find this movie anywhere because Windows isn't a movie. It's called Widows.
Yeah. Well, you know, the funny thing is, Chaney, is that my brain kept putting an in in there every single time for Windows. And I tried looking it up too, and I thought because it's just the word, it wasn't coming up immediately. It was showing me Windows instead. So I would type in Windows, Viola Davis, and then it would come up. And I still didn't make the connection that I was reading it incorrectly. And I think like it might have been halfway through the movie, or maybe I even watched the entire movie before I realized that it was Widows and not Windows. Because I was like, why is it called Windows? I was like, it's more about these windows.
Oh. No, what first popped up was that Johnny Depp movie, not Rear Window, because that's Hitchcock, but it was a Johnny Depp something Windows.
Rear Window. No, that's
what I just said.
Yeah, I know. What is it called? I know it's a thriller, right?
Yeah. Let's see. Windows. I'm just going to type Windows movie.
Johnny Depp.
Fine. Boop, 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 boop. See, and this is why I'm not a researcher, because I don't know what to type in. Secret Window.
That's it.
Secret Window. So that's
Secret
what,
Rear Window.
That's what popped up, and I was like, this is not the Viola Davis movie that I saw online. And then I realized I actually read the synopsis and realized that it was about widows, and then I made the connection. You know, reading is hard.
It's very embarrassing. Okay.
Now that we've got that embarrassment out of the way, just so everybody knows, there will be spoilers in this one.
There is no way we can really talk about it without spoiling things.
No. No. And if you haven't seen How to Get Away with Murder, then you might want to fast forward through this part because I'm going to talk about that show real fast and there's going to be some spoilers in that too. So,
great.
Yes. Fast forward for about 2 minutes. What I thought was really interesting about this movie was there were a lot of similarities between, what was her name, Victoria?
Mm-hmm.
Victoria and Annalise Keating in How to Get Away with Murder. She marries a white man. Their son dies. Mm-hmm. He tries to kill her.
Oh, her name is Veronica.
Veronica. And she is a fierce, intelligent woman who will stop at nothing to do what she needs to do to survive. So I just found that interesting that there were so many similarities. Still a very different character. But anyway.
Yes.
Just that.
Yes, but she brings the same kind of gravitas that she brings.
Absolutely.
Probably to everything she does. Like, I'm really excited to be able to see her other work and see what she brings to the table.
She is a force. And I sent you something on Instagram that my friend Scott sent me. Did you see it?
Yes, I did.
It's an interview that has with somebody. I don't even know who the interviewee is, but she's talking about the imbalance or injustice within the film industry as far as race goes and what is the word? Gender, I guess? Gender equality?
Yes.
And she says that no matter what she brings, that she does not get paid as much as the people that she's compared to, and that she often gets compared to Meryl Streep, that she is the black Meryl Streep. Then they go and say, but you're so unique. And she's like, well, if I'm unique, then why am I being paid less, why am I not being treated equal as Meryl Streep? And let me just say, she is not the Black Meryl Streep. She is Viola Davis. She is amazing. She brings something that nobody else does. She is her own unique, fantastic actress and such a powerhouse for women's rights and for Black women's rights. And she's just an amazing force in life.
Agreed.
Now, let's get into this movie. Now that that's said. Now, this movie, there's no way that we cannot bring up certain aspects of what's going on in this world right now that are portrayed in this movie.
There's some really heavy and serious themes in this movie, and Chaney and I are going to do our best to talk about them. We are not experts, and we will probably fail to talk about them in the fullest that they deserve, but we're going to do the best that we can.
And we are two white women.
Yes.
And we want to know what we say wrong. We want to learn. We want to grow. We want to listen. So if we say something wrong or we say something offensive, it is not intended. And please let us know, because we would like to fix that. So we are going to do our best to approach this in the most sensitive and considerate way that we know how to. All right, let's dive right in.
Okay, so I drew first, and I actually drew the genre horror, which Viola Davis is not really in horror movies, except for Disturbia, which Chaney mentioned earlier, and she has such a small role in that that, you know, that's, I didn't want to do that. So I picked a thriller, which has some like similar themes that you would find in a horror movie. It just treats it completely differently because they're real.
Oh, absolutely. And real life is pretty horrific sometimes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we're doing Widows, which is a crime thriller about a crime heist involving money. So it's directed by Steve McQueen, who is an Academy Award winning director for 12 Years a Slave. And I believe this was his fourth major film. It was co-written by Steve McQueen and Gillian Flynn, who is the author of Sharp Objects and Gone Girl, which have...
Ooh, Gone Girl.
...have been adapted into a television show and a movie, respectively. And it's starring a bunch of people, a bunch of familiar faces. It's an incredible cast.
An all-star cast.
Yeah, I mean, and everybody brings something incredible to the movie. So we have Viola Davis, who is the lead, and this is actually her first lead role in a major studio production. Everything else was kind of categorized as a supporting role, which at this point, she was already an Academy Award winner.
For Doubt?
Is it Doubt? Probably. We'll get to those movies eventually, I'm sure. But this was her first leading role. And then we have Liam Neeson, who plays her husband. And then we have Michelle Rodriguez, who plays Linda.
Who I want to cover at some point. Love her.
Actually, there's a lot of women in this movie that I would love to cover at another point in time. Because Michelle Rodriguez, I've seen her in movies for a while now. And I don't really know much about her, but I love her every single time I see her.
Yeah, she can do no wrong. I just love her.
And then Elizabeth Debicki, I hope that's how you say her name, plays Alice. She's also amazing. And we have Robert Duvall, who plays Tom Mulligan.
Oof.
Horrible, horrible, horrible racist character.
There's not one thing that comes out of his mouth that I'm like, okay.
He's okay. And you also like have the stark difference of how he speaks with his son and then how he steps out of a door and talks to his constituents.
Watching this movie, I was like, ooh, I hate money. I hate politics. I hate them. I hate the hokey pokey at weddings. I just, I could not. It just, the corruption that this money and the politics in this community, it just... Oh, it's so sickening. And that's the reality for so many people.
Right, the reality in Chicago.
Yeah.
It's like a lot of this was pulled from real situations and racial violence and politics that are happening in Chicago, even though it is a fictional story.
Well, art is mimicking life, right?
Yeah, well, actually, in fact, so I'm getting to the next person who stars in this movie, Colin Farrell, who plays Jack Mulligan, the younger dynasty politician. There was a woman who worked for the film, and she collected a bunch of genuine Chicago accents and brought them to let the director and the actors decide which accent best suited the characters, and then coach them on their lines after they made those decisions. But it's funny because I don't know if you noticed, but Colin Farrell sounds very Irish throughout like almost all of the movie.
It sounded interesting. I'll say that.
He is Irish.
Ah.
Both he and Liam Neeson are both Irish. And I think that maybe the Chicago accent was a little hard. I don't know. Or maybe there is like this kind of mashed together Irish Chicago accent, which is a genuine accent. But I would think that he would sound like his father, Robert Duvall, and he doesn't.
Well, you know, he said in the movie that he is his mother's son.
Ah, there's the loophole.
There you go.
And his mother was Irish.
Sure.
And so then we have Brian Tyree Henry as Jamal, who is the opposing politician.
Yes.
And then Daniel Kaluuya.
Oh my goodness. He is amazing.
He plays Jatem, who is the brother of Jamal. I think he has one of the outstanding performances in this movie.
Absolutely. And what I love about him is, I mean, I've only seen him in three things, which is Black Panther, Get Out, and now this. And each time he steps into a role, it's so vastly different.
He has a huge range.
And so in depth. I believe him so much in everything he does. And in this movie, I am so afraid of him. He is terrifying. And I love it.
Yes. I mean, every time he steps onto the screen, you know, like I was like, what's going to happen? What's going to happen?
Oh, completely unpredictable, spontaneous. Terrifying.
Oh, like the chaotic scene in the gymnasium?
Yes.
Well, okay, so I couldn't find a whole lot about this movie other than like a whole bunch of interviews. Like there's a really great interview that I found of Viola Davis talking about her experience in it, but I couldn't really figure out how to paraphrase it without just reading her entire interview, which we can't really do.
Right.
Because she has so many amazing things to say in any situation, it seems. So she had a great experience doing this with Steve McQueen. One thing that I remember from the interview is that she says that Steve McQueen really sees you as an actor and brings that out in you. So like one of the things that I did come across that kind of supports what she said is that the cinematography in the movie, which I don't know if that stood out to you, but it definitely stood out to me. There are so many really interesting shots that happen, like the one where Colin Farrell and his assistant, I can't remember her name, get in the car and they have a conversation in the car, but you don't see any of that. You just see part of the car as they're moving down the street from the outside.
Which I think that it's supposed to show the transition from the 18th ward into the outer of the 18th ward where it's about to turn into a different ward.
Really good point.
Yeah, so you see the inner city and then you see all of a sudden you're in mansion territory.
Yeah, what an incredible cinematographical choice.
Cinematographical. I like it. I actually went back and rewound it to watch because I was so focused on the dialogue. I was like, why did they choose to do that? That's such a strange choice. So I rewound it and watched it again. And
you noticed it.
Yeah, I noticed it. So it was really interesting.
Yeah, it's funny. I thought that maybe it was to have you focus on the dialogue in a different way because you can't see the faces. You're not distracted by the acting. I mean, you just have the voice acting. Anyway, what I was going to say, the cinematography was described, like in the things that I was looking at, as a documentary approach because only the stunt scenes were storyboarded. Everything else, what the camera was reacting to what the actors and their choices were. Isn't that interesting? Rather than the actors having to play to the camera.
I like the idea.
That might have given it this raw, more real feel to it. I wish that I had read that before I watched the movie, so I could have paid more attention to it.
Yeah, I guess I'm going to have to watch it a third time. By the way, you can find this on Amazon Prime for $3.99.
Yes, good thinking, Janie.
You're welcome. And be sure to type in widows, not windows.
Yeah. Widows. Okay. The original cut for this movie was 3 hours.
It is a long movie.
It's 2 hours. It's a little over 2 hours. Can you imagine all of the content that they must have cut out if it was 3 hours long?
I'm curious what the content was, because it's a lot of storytelling and not a lot of action for a heist movie. Because when I first read the description, I was like, okay, it's going to be a heist movie. I actually really enjoy heist movies. I wouldn't consider this a heist movie. And yes, they say it's a thriller, and the few moments where there are actions are very thrilling. My heart was racing, but really I would consider this a drama. So I'm curious how much that they cut was more of the storytelling or how much was action.
That's a really good question. But you're talking about heist movies and how you like them. Mm-hmm. That made me remember that Viola Davis said something about, like, she, in that interview that I was reading, about how she often has issues with heist movies, because a big thing for her is, how does this character start in this, like, relatively normal life and then get pushed into this really extreme crime? Mm-hmm. So for her, like, she needed to have that in her character. Mm-hmm. And in the interview, this is what she said. She's threatened with her life and her dog's life, which that I think is the big turning point. Him holding the dog, Jamal holding the dog.
Poor puppy.
Yes.
I love Westies, by the way. I've always wanted a little Westie. So when he held that poor doggy by its neck, my heart stopped.
Oh, yeah. I hated that part. Like, the whole time he's holding the dog, I'm like, this is not good. This is not good. And then he holds it up, and I'm like, oh, that's what I was afraid of the whole time.
That poor puppy.
Yeah, so then she goes on to say that she's lost her son. She's lost her husband. She has no idea how she's going to pay her bills. She is sinking under the weight of that depression. And this act of criminality, it's almost like a metaphor for her taking ownership of her life. But at the same time, it's a way to pay that rent. It's a way to survive. And that's how I approached it.
Yeah. And I think that's very clear in her performance.
Mm-hmm. The movie did very, very well critically. It got accolades from many, many different critics across the board for directing, editing, screenplay, and performances, especially with Viola Davis's performance.
I don't even remember hearing about it.
Yeah, it's interesting. I didn't write this down, but they kind of underplayed it with the advertising. So it didn't really get a lot of traction at the theaters, although it was successful. It made more than its original budget. And so for her performance, Viola Davis did get a BAFTA nomination for actress in the leading role.
What is that?
British Academy of Film and Television Arts. Now, one thing that I thought was really interesting about the making of this film, that Steve McQueen was inspired to make this movie because there was a television series that it's adapted from the 80s called Widows. It was a 2-part miniseries, and the story of the movie is based on the first miniseries of 6 episodes, which I think was interesting to learn, because as I was watching it, I was like, why didn't they make this into a series? Because it's so complex, mm-hmm. with so many different characters. Mm-hmm. It was really hard to follow what was happening for at least half the movie.
The second time through, I was like, oh, I get everything. And there are so many moments that if you don't know what's going on, you miss. So I was really glad to have watched it a second time. And I would encourage you to watch it a second time too, because it just brings so many different levels to a lot of the characters and their choices. Mm-hmm. And the movie in general. So yeah, I would say watch it twice.
Okay. For sure. That makes a lot of sense, because there were just like, there's just a lot of different narratives to keep track of before they all get tied together. Mm-hmm. And you all more often see that kind of writing these days in television. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was interesting. And then the only other thing, and I think that this rounds out my 5-point criteria, is that Olivia, the dog, her name is actually Olivia, and she has not only been in this movie, but she also appears in the movie Game Night and the Netflix show Insatiable.
She's a star.
Yeah, she's a little puppy star.
I love that. Have you seen Insatiable?
I have not.
It's a trip. Okay, well then let's just dive into the movie then.
Let's do it.
Okay. I really didn't know what I was in for. I mean, I read the little synopsis, but again, like I said, I thought it was a general heist movie. Again, not what this is.
No.
After I learned that they were widows, spoiler alert, but not really, their husbands have to die because they're called widows.
Well, and that happens pretty quickly.
Yes, but at the very, very opening of the scene, it's uh-huh. Liam Neeson and Viola Davis making out, and he is like eating her face.
Yes.
It very much reminded me of how the husband in Sleeping with the Enemy was drinking the water from the water fountain.
Yeah.
But I was having this inner dialogue, like, why is he eating her face? This is so awkward. And then the next thing he does is he growls and, like, tries to actually eat her face in a playful way.
Yes, and it cuts immediately to the heist that's happening and of volleying gunshots. It actually made me jump. That yes. editing transition frightened me.
It did. It made me jump, too. And I loved the little tiny interactions that they showed between each couple at the beginning, just to give you a little glimpse into whatever...
the relationships.
Yeah, what each relationship was like. The guy that was with Alice, I can't remember what his name is. He played Shane in Walking Dead.
Yeah, Florek. John Benthal.
Yeah. She has a bruise on her face.
Oh, it was so upsetting.
And
he pokes her.
Right.
In the bruise.
But he's like, poke, poke, poke. Playful. Yeah. And my brain could not comprehend how he could be so playful but hurting her at the same time. Ugh, ugh.
He says something about, can you put makeup on that or something? It makes me feel bad to look at it. She's like, well, it made me feel bad too.
Disgusting.
Disgusting. And then he kisses her.
Ugh, okay, anyway. And then the woman with the baby, their little interaction, which I was like, okay, why are they showing this? There's not much there. And then...
No, but it's interesting because that you figure out why later.
Then Michelle Rodriguez and her husband.
She owns a quinceanera shop.
Yes. And even though they were kind of having a little bit of a squabble, you could tell there was so much love between them.
Mm-hmm.
Then all of a sudden, there was an explosion and all the men die. And you're like,
whoa.
Well, damn. Whoa,
like all of those familiar faces are just gone in the first 2 minutes of the movie.
Just bye. And I was
like, why does Liam Neeson top build for this movie?
Well, yeah.
I think he's the second build after Viola Davis.
Yeah, and I was like, I don't understand what's happening. I mean, I knew that they were going to die, but I guess there's going to be a lot of backflashes. What are they called? Flashbacks?
Flashbacks.
Backflashes. But yeah, anyway, I was just really, really taken aback by that. But what I really loved about the beginning of this film is that the first three scenes that you see Viola Davis, she doesn't talk.
Mm-mm.
Then the first sound that she really makes is when she just releases this scream, this guttural, visceral scream. And it's so beautiful. The way that she immediately, after she screams, she pulls it all back in, tucks it all away, puts those emotions away, wipes her face, and then is presentable again. And it's, I've had to do that before. It's not a fun experience to have to tuck that away. And she makes it so believable and so raw. I thought that was a really lovely way to start her performance in this.
Mm-hmm. What happens next?
All the funerals.
Oh, yes.
I think.
All the funerals.
The lady with the baby, when they show the clip of her at her husband's funeral, I was like, does this woman have any feelings? I mean, I understand, you know, everybody goes through all sorts of different emotions when they lose somebody. There's, you yes. can't really judge. But
there seemed to be something off.
There seemed to be something off. Especially for someone who just gave birth to a baby. And then the father dies. Yeah. Something just didn't seem right.
Yeah, I'm glad that you watched this movie twice because, like I said, I can't remember all of it, especially in the order because of everything that was going on.
Mm-hmm.
I think there is a point in which everything starts to make sense and it's much easier to keep track of the narrative.
Uh-huh.
but it's nice that you picked up on these things watching it through a second time, knowing what was coming.
Oh, yeah. Anyway, all the men that died in the first heist, the men's heist, mm-hmm. that was stealing from the Mannings, which is Jamal.
Okay, and that's, yeah.
It took all of his campaign money, which that was what he needed to at least be on par with Jack Mulligan. There's a lot of stuff that happens with political. We're just going to put that aside for now.
Okay, so we're in the gym.
We're in the gym because they're trying to figure out why Harry, who is Viola Davis's husband, Liam Neeson.
Late husband.
Why he stole their campaign money. So the two people that apparently had the money or were transporting the money, they decided, oh, hey, let's go hide, but also let's rap.
Yeah, we're going to beatbox in this box. When that happened, I really was very confused as to what was going on.
It seems like little children, like, let's hide, and then they can't hear us because we're hiding.
We got caught, yeah.
Yeah, out of sight, you can't, if I can't see you, you can't see me. But unfortunately for them, that was not the case. And what is the brother's name? What is Jamal's brother's name?
Jatem.
Yeah, speaking to his spontaneous, chaotic nature, disposes of them pretty quickly, but not before he's like, oh, y'all were rapping. Why don't you show me your rap? And then shoots the rapper in the head mid-rap.
Yeah, it's very shocking.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And that was one of the camera works that I read about with that approach, mm-hmm. that in that scene, the camera is moving like 360 around them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going with the action of the actors as they're making their acting choices.
Is that because Jatem was like getting up all in the guy's face, the rapper's face, and
yes,
trying to intimidate him, and they wanted to see all that?
I guess, yeah. So.
That was really good. It was a very, very intense moment because I was like, this guy is in danger. I don't think that he should be rapping right now. So then it goes to Viola Davis's husband's funeral, which is Harry's funeral. And she says that they picked out like three different gray caskets for her to choose from or something like that. That casket was beautiful.
She also says something about how they should have hired gravediggers,
mm-hmm.
because Harry would not have liked the backhoe.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked that up because I was curious. And they do not hire people to dig graves by hand anymore. And the reason for that is because to use a backhoe to dig a grave takes 30 minutes. To dig a grave by hand, it takes no less than 8 hours. Anyway, I was just curious. I know that's a little bit of a digression.
It was an interesting one, though. It was a lovely funeral. And the fact that she cared so much just showed how much she really loved him.
Yeah.
But then we move on to, it goes to her house. That's where she meets Jamal.
Right. That's where my brain just automatically leapt to, because that was a long scene and it was a very intense scene.
But before she even meets him, he knocks on the door. I don't know how tall she is. We're going to have to find out. But I know at our house here, the peephole, I can't even stand on my tiptoes to see through my peephole. And apparently she couldn't either.
Yeah.
And I don't understand why peepholes are not an average height.
I'm going to go out on a limb here and say, just like many things in this world, they have been tailored to the average height of men and not thought about women. But you're right. Most of them are, you know, much taller than I am. And I am average height for a woman.
Right. I don't open my door because I can't see out of it. I think that that's something that really needs to change. You hear that, door making people? Change the peephole height, because women need to see who is at their door.
Or include more than one.
You know what? A man can bend down to see through a hole. Okay? Let them try some squats, okay? Squatting is really healthy. It builds up those muscles. I can stand on my tiptoes, still can't see that peephole. So either I go and get a step stool, or men bend their knees.
And by the time you get that step stool, they might have, you know, walked away.
Which, I mean, if they do, bye. you didn't need to talk to me in the first place. Which, I mean, that's a whole other subject. I hate when people come and ring my doorbell. I feel like it's an invasion of privacy, even though I'm like, how else are they going to get my attention?
So I've had people come and knock on the door here.
Mm-hmm.
So I have not lived in this house except during the pandemic. So when people knock on your door now, it's especially alarming because you're like, who is trying to get a hold of me? Like, who is coming to my door and who's going to get closer than 6 feet from my face? And it was just weird.
But another reason why I just don't open my door anymore, because I don't trust anybody anymore. Yeah. And if I can't see through the peephole,
keep your germs out my house.
Get out. Get out.
Hey, why did you pause it?
Potty break.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Don't go too far. We'll be right back. Enjoying Two Sisters Present America's Sweethearts? Feel free to leave us a review.
Tell us what you love.
And if you must, tell us what you don't love.
I don't love mayonnaise.
I mean about the podcast.
Right.
Contact us through Twitter, Instagram, or email.
Find our handles on our website, www.twosisterspresent.com.
You can also join our Patreon with exclusive content and access to picking your own movie or artist for us to cover.
What? You can pick the next America's Sweetheart?
Sure can. Find out all the info at www.patreon.com/twosisterspresent.
Thank you and goodbye.
Later. Hey, Bailey, I think it's time for some sponsor appreciation. What do you think?
Sponsor appreciation time! Yay!
This series is sponsored by Lindsay from Lime Life by Alcone.
Lime Life started as a small store in the theater district of New York, selling all natural skincare and makeup products to starlets on the stage and screen. Very our brand.
Lime Life is Leaping Bunny certified, cruelty-free, organic and chemical-free without sacrificing its performance. And a major selling factor for Bailey and I, most of the products are certified gluten-free.
Yes, thank you for not trying to kill us. They're all about supporting women, sending funds to charities like the Women's Empowerment Initiative, helping women all over the world.
I can't say enough good things about this company.
But what about the product?
Well, I've been using my face wash and moisturizer every day for a month, and I'll just say this. I got on Zoom for Halloween, and my friend did a double take and said, "Oh, Chaney, I was about to say, who is that child?"
Wow.
My skin is looking younger, brighter, healthier, and is velvety soft. It's amazing what a skincare regimen and a hat can do.
Wow, that's amazing.
And for the people with sensitive skin like myself, the charcoal and tea tree oil soap is gentle yet hydrating.
And it smells so good.
Oh, so good.
Honestly, committing to a skincare regimen every day, it feels really good, and it's very pampering.
Visit their website at limelifebyalcone.com/LindseyHinkle27. That's LindseyHinkle27.
Or contact Lindsay for personalized care and finding the exact product that's right for you. Find her on Instagram at Linz27. That's LINZ27.
Thanks, Lindsay, for all the samples.
We are all about that Lime lifestyle.
Yeah.
Ready?
Oh, super ready.
3, 2, 1, go.
Moving back to the movie. Yeah, that scene where she meets Jamal and he threatens her and she's like, "I'll call the police." And he says, "Do you know what the police did when your husband died? They laughed. They picked up whatever was left of his body and scraped it up into a bag and laughed.
And had no thought for the widow."
Yes. I think it was that moment where she was like, "I have absolutely nothing."
Yeah, she learns that what ended up killing her husband was a heist in which he stole $2 million?
$2 million.
$2 million from Jamal Manning. And he demands her to repay it as the person that has survived.
Yeah.
Harry. That's such a weird term.
Yeah. But she did kind of survive Harry.
Right. She's lost everything, and he's holding one of the only other things that she really cares about in his hands.
Yeah. Her precious little Olivia dog.
Cutie patootie.
Cutie patootie. And I just want to say real fast, I love her costumes. Whoever the costume designer was for this movie put her in so many things that just complimented her skin tone or her figure. She just was radiant throughout this entire movie.
Yeah, you're right. You notice the costumes more than I do.
Well, it was really stylish. She looked stellar.
There was one dress that I did notice, and I guess we'll get to it eventually.
Alice's dress?
Yeah, the gold dress that she says she calls a condom.
Yes, it's tight.
It's funny, actually, Michelle Rodriguez improvised that line.
Did she really?
Yes, and the costumer, what's the appropriate title? Costume manager?
Costume designer, wardrobe assistant, a person who handles clothes.
Person in charge of wardrobe.
Yes. Wardrobe master.
Yeah, she was particularly pleased. Wardrobe master. Wardrobe lord. She was particularly pleased when Michelle ad-libbed that because she had wanted it to look not that classy. I forgot the word that she used.
So when she finally gets the notebook that mm-hmm. was left to her by Harry, she goes to a bar. And do you know who the guy in the wheelchair is?
I recognized him, but I couldn't figure it out.
He is Benny in The Mummy.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow. Huh.
And he was also in a movie called Peggy Sue Gets Married. I love that movie. It's with Kathleen Turner. But I saw that movie after I saw The Mummy, too. So every time that I see this actor, all I think is Benny. When she's talking about how the Mannings are planning on hurting her if she doesn't turn over the money, he's like, well, how do you think I got in this wheelchair? And all I could think of, the scarabs.
That's funny.
Because he's left in the tomb when all the scarabs are coming after him. I'm sorry to this actor. I know that all of these roles are very different, but Benny was just so iconic. He will always be in my head.
Well, it's just that movie is terrible, but we've all watched it multiple times. Either
Bailey,
we saw it in the...
Terrible? How very dare?
How very accurate, really.
That movie, The Mummy, it's a great film.
No, okay. I love it. I love it, but it is terrible. I have a very interesting memory regarding The Mummy, because I saw that in the theater with two friends, and these two friends happened to be dating at the time. And one of those friends, it was supposed to be just me and her going to this movie, and she asked if she could bring her boyfriend, and I was like, I guess. And so we go into the movie theater, and I sit down next to them because we're at this movie theater together, right? And they just start making out right next to me. At first, I'm like kind of surprised, and then like a little embarrassed, and then I get really, really angry. And I got so angry because I thought it was so insensitive that I stood up, you know, with a lot of energy, stood up and marched forward to like three rows ahead of them and sat by myself and just stewed in it.
You stood up with gusto.
I stood up with gusto and then sat down and stewed.
Well, I don't blame you. Moving back to the movie. Boop, 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 boop. Okay. A lot of stuff happens. I don't even know because I didn't write anything down. The next thing I wrote down is, okay, the scene where Benny, the guy in the wheelchair, is at the bowling alley and Jatem comes in and is asking why Harry was after the money.
Yes. Yes, I do remember that scene. It was a really hard scene to watch.
I think that was one of the hardest scenes for me to watch. I had to look away. It's because I looked away that I had this thought. How do they get the sound effect for stabbing? Do they, like, stab some pork?
I've seen some videos of sound foley, but I find sound foley to be endlessly fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm present in my mind enough, I like to pay attention to the sounds that I'm making and thinking like what they could represent in a movie sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I think it depends on the stabbing and like what kind of knife and stuff. So they probably have different things that they do stab. But I have seen them stabbing watermelons.
Ah, okay.
Especially for horror movies.
So they actually have a soundstage in one of the schools here in Houston. I can't remember which school, but it's an actual sound foley stage, and I got to go on it. It was really cool. They have stones set up and sand and like different things that you can walk on to make sound. It's really, mm-hmm. really cool. It's really fascinating.
That's awesome.
But turning away and listening to that stabbing sound, maybe was even worse. I don't know, but stabbing a paralyzed man 3 times in his legs. so that he can't feel. Je t'aime has a very, very sick mind.
Mm-hmm. And then he stabs him in the arm and says, you could feel that, couldn't you?
Yeah. Yeah.
And then he just leaves him like halfway up a lane just to bleed because he can only pull himself by his arms.
Yeah, and he moves his wheelchair even further away. It's gives me the shivers. Gives me the shivers. Okay. All right, sir.
Well, I also want to talk about the sauna scene.
Okay.
So Veronica has been trying to get these women together because she figures that they are all in a similar situation as she has found herself in. Probably not being threatened in the same way, but definitely being left in the lurch by their deceased husband. Mm-hmm. And so she thinks that if anybody is going to team up with her, it'll be these other widows. The sauna is the first meeting. And so she starts talking to them. And then this other woman walks in and they just stare at her for a while. And then she's like, I'm just going to keep talking about what I want to talk about. And she gets up, starts pouring a ridiculous amount of water on those hot rocks, putting a whole bunch of steam into the room. And she says, I have a business proposition if you have a high risk threshold, and looks straight at the woman.
The stranger. Yeah.
The stranger. And the stranger immediately stands up and runs out of the door. And I thought to myself, I don't know if I would have clued in as fast as that lady did. I would have been definitely uncomfortable. Like, why is this lady putting so much water on the rocks? Like, she's going to choke us all out. But I would have, like, very high risk threshold. Wonder what she's talking about. I don't know if I would have run out, like, the way that she did. So, you know, that lady's much smarter than I think I would be in that scenario. I probably would have just looked at her as, like, do you own this sauna?
Yeah, I would have been like, okay, I'm just gonna ignore y'all. Y'all are obviously having a conversation. I'm just gonna close my eyes and enjoy the sauna.
Yeah. Yeah.
Clearly she's not talking to me. I probably wouldn't even have looked at her when she was doing the rocks because I try to avoid eye contact. Well, when I'm naked.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to look at anybody when I have a towel around me. But
yeah, you don't want to make hard eye contact with someone else in a sauna when you're all wearing towels.
So I probably wouldn't have even noticed that she was talking to me about a high risk threshold. I probably would have just been like, do 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 do, life is fine.
There were moments in which, you know, I took a step outside of watching the movie and realized that I was really struggling with keeping up with what was happening in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those moments was when she walks into the warehouse with her dog and Bash drops her off. And I thought, I thought it had something to do with the heist she was planning, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, why is she walking her dog into this warehouse that looks like a criminal organization has been operating within it? And then she picks up the jacket and smells it. And I'm like, oh, this is where her husband organized things. I feel like that was my experience throughout a lot of this movie where I'm like, what is happening? What is happening? What is happening? Oh, okay.
I actually did get that one. That's okay that you didn't, because the dog started barking and scratching at his jacket and then she picked it up and smelled it. So I was like, oh, the dog misses him.
And now that you say that, I realize that is foreshadowing what happens later. I really do feel in some ways this movie is just a lot smarter than I am, because when there was that reveal, and I know we're skipping ahead a little bit, but when the dog is scratching on the door at the woman that just had the baby's house, because she hasn't been coming to the heist meetings, and Viola Davis is just like checking in on her, and the dog goes and starts scratching at the door, and I'm like, someone's obviously back there. And then she stares at the door for a while and looks at a flask, and she picks up the dog and keeps staring at the door and starts to like get teary-eyed, and then she leaves. And I was still shocked when the lady opened the door and it was Liam Neeson.
So as soon as the dog started scratching and they showed the flask, I was like, oh, they were having an affair. But I thought that it was some other article of clothing behind the door of his. I did not think it was going to be him because...
Okay, so you and I both had different ideas. Like, you knew it had something to do with the husband. I thought someone was behind the door. So together, we figured it out.
Partially, I didn't think it was Liam Neeson because in my mind, it was a closet. And why would he just be hanging out in a closet? But it was a full-on room. He was sitting on a bed.
Did you know that the twist was going to be that he was still alive?
No.
Yeah, no. I think that that was one of the most surprising twists I think I've experienced in a long time. I was very, very surprised.
But I did know that he was going to come back for the money at the end. As soon as he was revealed to be alive, I was like, oh, this is not going to be good.
Yeah. There were a couple of things that I wanted to bring up. One, Belle.
Yes, Belle.
The woman that plays Belle. Cynthia Erivo. I really love her character.
I really, really enjoyed Belle. When she first comes in, when Linda brings her in, and Veronica is like, who is this? Why is she here? Blah, blah, blah. Talking to Linda. And she's like, I'm right here. You can address me.
Yeah.
I don't have to be here. So
yeah, it's like, I don't want to be here. I can leave.
Yeah. So either you talk to me and treat me like an actual person or I'm gone. And I was like, yes. Okay. All right, Belle.
Yeah. The actress, Cynthia Erivo, I think that she's just recently made the transition to film from stage. She was a Broadway actor. But anyway, I'd really love to cover her at some point because it seems like the few movies that she has been in have been like pretty.
Okay. All right.
Okay, so I did have written down, like, how Alice, how, like, it was not just her husband that abused her. It's, like, a theme throughout the movie that people are constantly hitting her. Because they're always trying to diminish her and make her seem small so that she can be controlled more easily. It's also interesting because she's probably the tallest person in this movie. She's 6'4", I think, in real life.
I mean, if you're trying to get away as a man in a heist, being 6'4 is a good way to do it.
Yeah, like to masquerade as a man.
Yeah.
So the scene that she has with her husband was really bad. And the scene that she has with her mom is almost worse. She says that she'd like to go get a job. That is her productive way of dealing with this horrible situation that her husband has left her in. And her mom says, no, it's the man's job to provide for a woman. And then tells her pretty much that she needs to sell herself for sex.
Yeah, she sets her up on a website to be an escort.
The men will buy you nice gifts and take you fancy places. What a woman deserves. The way of setting that up is so disgusting and manipulative. It was very upsetting. It's really interesting to watch her character arc throughout the movie. Because she'll go into places, and because people have always underestimated her, she uses that to her advantage.
She's incredibly resourceful and very smart, and people keep saying that she's stupid, and she's not.
No, she figures it out. Like when she goes into the gun shop and gets the woman to buy a gun for her.
Three guns. She wants one for each room.
Yeah, one for each room. Yeah, and then she walks outside, head held high, and bites a big bite out of a hot dog.
Yeah, I would like to think that she moves on.
Okay, so one of the other scenes that I wanted to bring up is with Linda. Her job is to find out information, trying to track down Delia. Delia? It takes her to this man's house. She is trying to pump him for information, not knowing that his wife has died. And he's, like, obviously still hasn't recovered from that loss.
Yeah, she died 4 months ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's just like, you need to leave. You're not who you say you are. And then she sits down. She's like, oh, shit. And he's like, I asked you to leave. She says, my husband died 2 weeks ago. And she just starts crying.
He pulls her in to hug her and just console her. And she melts into his body. And then they kind of pull away. And then they both start kissing. It gets intense for a few seconds. And then she pulls away and says, oh, my God, I'm so sorry. And runs away.
I think that part stood out to me because it had very little to do with the rest of the story. And it was just a moment of showing what has been going on with her, because she has not really had time to grieve her husband. None of them really have. And they're already like trying to make ends meet, figure out how to support their families, get her business back. She's lost her business. She has a moment where she's a very human moment where she feels terrible that she's been trying to ask him for information, like to be duplicitous with this man that has lost his wife because she's lost her husband. It's one of those things where, like, you see it represented occasionally where someone is grieving.
they seek out a physical intimacy, I guess, to distract. But they're brought together because of such a similar experience. And it's one that I can't relate to, but it seems so powerful. Mm-hmm. And so horrifying and embarrassing and so sad, so sad. So anyway, I don't know. That scene really stuck out to me.
Oh, no. As soon as you said you wanted to talk about Linda, I knew that this was the scene you were going to talk about. But let's talk a little bit about Veronica and Harry's relationship a little bit.
Yes. Okay. Something really important happens.
Yes. From the beginning, you see these glimpses of love. And even right after he dies, she envisions him coming behind her and holding her. There's all these loving moments that they have with each other. And then it slowly progresses into, oh, they were not perfect. Something is going on.
They had something happen.
She says, I never imagined marrying a white man. And he starts to fondle her. And she says, having sex with me is not going to help the situation. And then he says that he doesn't want having a child with her to be his only regret. And she says, well, if you had a child with someone else, maybe he'd be alive. And I didn't know what that meant. Mm-hmm. I was thinking, I was like, okay, well, maybe she had a miscarriage.
Yeah, that's kind of where I went at first.
Something very personal to her. And then we move on to, and this is going to be one of the more difficult parts of the show, which is when their son actually dies.
Yes.
Because he's driving this very, very expensive, beautiful car. He's by himself. He's, I guess, 16, 17. Mm-hmm. And he's on the phone with Harry, his dad. Harry left something in the car and he's like, Dad, I told Mom I was going to take the car. She heard me.
I'm going to miss the basketball game.
I'm going to miss the game. I can turn around, but I'm going to miss the game. And Harry asks him to turn around. So he turns the car around. And as you see him turning, you see a cop car in the background. And as soon as I saw that car, I was like, oh, he's going to get pulled over. He's going to get pulled over. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, he does. And so he's telling his dad, Dad, I just got pulled over. I have to handle this. And in the background, you hear the cops saying, get out of the car. Show me your hands. Don't move.
He hears that his dad is still on the phone, that he put the phone down without ending the call because he can hear his dad's voice. And he goes, oh, shit. And then he leans over to get the phone.
And then they shoot him 3 times.
Yeah.
It's very, very sad.
For an illegal U-turn.
Obviously, that is very indicative of what's going on in our country. And yes, how Black people are targeted and not given the benefit of the doubt. It's just, oh, they're Black, they're a risk. We can't trust that they're not going to reach for a gun.
Yeah.
He's driving a nice car. He must have stolen it.
Yeah. So our country has a long history of police brutality that is disproportionately directed at people of color, especially Black men. And the fact that the scene represents a real systemic problem, where a group of people are violently singled out based on the color of their skin, is absolutely devastating.
Yes. You and I cannot understand. Fundamentally, we can't understand what that community goes through on a daily basis. The injustice and the
tragedy
and the judgment. It's so incredibly unfair and wrong. And I mean, those words don't even encompass it. When that happened, I almost had to turn the movie off.
I don't think I was able to pay attention to the next couple scenes.
Yeah. Then you have the dad that's still on the phone listening to all this happen. Mm-hmm. And then the guilt that Veronica has just because the color of her skin.
Yeah.
Because she passed that on to her son. It's just, it is gutting.
Mm-hmm. So marriages often have a hard time and struggle with maintaining the relationship when there's the loss of a child. Mm-hmm. And it's even more to deal with in this kind of situation.
Yes. There's so much that we can say about Black Lives Matter.
I think that there's hope that there is a lot of changes going on right now because of all of the protesting.
Yes.
It's just really important that we don't let that momentum stall.
No.
That we keep pushing, that we stay vigilant, we inform ourselves, read books, watch movies, watch YouTube. There's so many different avenues in which you can get information and educate yourself. And mm-hmm. it's really important that you take the time to do that and then find the way that you can help the most so that tragedies like what is depicted in this movie don't happen in our present any longer, and they don't happen in the future. We're in the middle of a huge rewrite in our narrative as a country.
We are very much advocates of this movement and for equality for all of our brothers and sisters of any race and any sexual orientation.
Or gender identity.
We probably won't be taking very many moments like this unless a movie provokes it, but that is our stance, and if that bothers you, then bye. All right, so now that we've talked about this, we're gonna go ahead and move on to the digression of their relationship. So of course their son dies, and you can see how much that destroys both of them individually.
Mm-hmm.
And then of course you find out about the affair. I mean, she does not see him in that room. She just guesses, or we can guess that she guesses.
Uh-huh. But she's too afraid to look because of what it means.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just that her husband's alive and lied. It's not just that he's cheated on her. There's also a baby and all the significance that that means.
And he left her alone without owning anything. She doesn't own any of the property that she has. She doesn't own, like, part of when Manning came to her and was like, you owe me $2 million, liquidate. She couldn't liquidate because she doesn't own anything.
Right. He thought that he had set her up just by sending her the notebook and that he could sell
Harry,
the notebook.
Harry.
Harry sends her the notebook. He thought that she could sell the notebook and she'd be okay.
Yes.
And that was him washing his hands clean.
Yes. She's going to be fine. No. It's so, so messed up. He left her with nothing and couldn't care less. I mean, at the end, when he comes back after the heist is pulled and she could not wrap her head around what was going on. And he was like, I couldn't save us, Ronnie. I couldn't save our son. I couldn't save us. I had to save me. Me. She calls him a coward because he is. To leave your wife who has taken on so much guilt, who has done nothing but support you, to leave her that way without an oar in her boat.
Yeah.
And then just say that you had to save yourself.
Yes.
So I'm actually a little bit confused about the end. Just a little bit.
Okay.
Because I didn't really understand this part either. I felt like it wasn't really in the vein of the character. Maybe it was. But he said that he needs the money, Ronnie. I need the money, Ronnie. And then he slaps her and pushes her down. Yeah. And we had not seen any sort of violence toward her. Mm-mm. At that point.
No.
So it seemed a little out of left field for me.
He was getting desperate.
Yeah, but there's a way to do that that wasn't violent. He could have just moved her aside.
That's true.
The fact that it was a slap and then a push seemed... It just seemed a little out of left field. I mean, although he did kill his entire team, so, and didn't think twice about it. He looks in the car. Was the money actually in the car? Because he pulled out the gun after he looked in the car. So I was like, oh, is the money not there? Is that why he's pulling out the gun? Or is he just trying to close loose ends? The escalation of that character did not seem realistic. All of a sudden, he was a loving husband who was just distraught that they lost their son,
mm-hmm.
who was a criminal but didn't bring that home. And then all of a sudden, he's slapping her, pushing her down, and then is about to murder her.
Yeah, no, it didn't really track. I mean, other than maybe being an act of passion.
Maybe. But then she, you know, she pulls out the gun and shoots him. And she uses the gun that was used to kill... Senior Mulligan.
Yes.
To put into Harry's hand.
Yeah.
To frame him.
And that scene also was really interesting, the way that it was shot. The scene where Tom Mulligan was shot. He comes out and he's got a gun pointed on them. He's like, you're going to steal my money? And then he reveals Veronica's face and he mm-hmm. recognizes her. And he's like, what? In that moment, I can't remember what it is that gets him to shoot one of the women.
Because Alice goes to grab his gun. And when she does that, he pulls the trigger, shoots her in the shoulder. Then Michelle Rodriguez's character shoots him.
Yes. And he dies very quickly. He just crumples onto the floor.
Which Michelle Rodriguez is the one that could not hit the target at all.
Oh, you're right. Man, I really do need to watch that movie again.
Yeah. Alice was the dead aim and Michelle Rodriguez was not. She could not hit that target to save her life, but she sure got Mr. Mulligan.
Yes.
But my question is, so Viola Davis grabs Michelle Rodriguez's gun and tucks it into the back of her pants.
Uh-huh.
Then she uses that gun later to frame Harry for Mr. Mulligan's death.
Yes.
So did she know that Harry was going to come for the money? That this was going to be the end result? That she had to kill Harry and frame him? Because it just seems like such a coincidence that she grabbed that gun, kept it on her person, and then like almost immediately after she shot Harry, put that gun in his hand.
I think she knew he was going to come for her and the money because I think she figured out that he was alive. She's very smart. She put it together. And I think that there was a lot of denial in that because I don't think she wanted to believe it. But she figured he was going to come. And I think that that was her plan because she had worked out the way that it was going to happen. Because if he could do all that to her, of course, you know, he would do anything for the money, obviously. But I think she hoped that it wouldn't work out that way.
I also need to say, girl has some guns. Her arms are impressive. When she was unloading that money, I was like, holy cow, she is ripped.
I want arms.
I know. I was like, ooh, I got to start working out. Do some push-ups.
Okay, so I really liked the ending a lot. Veronica is eating alone, right?
Mm-hmm. And Alice meets a friend, which I feel really bad for this actress who meets Alice at this cafe who has all of these lines, but you never see her face.
Yeah. Well, she got paid.
She got paid. Good for you, girl.
But they see each other, but they don't say anything to each other.
Right.
And then Alice leaves first, and Veronica comes out after, and she calls after Alice and then starts asking how she's doing. And she has this, like, smile on her face, and it's so powerful because early on in the movie, she said that they were not friends, that their relationship was going to end as soon as this was over.
She was very adamant about that.
Yes.
She said it multiple times.
Yes.
That they go their own way, that it's not going to be a reunion.
It was just such a powerful moment for her to be able to move beyond that and just be a friend or just be a human with this person that they experienced this thing together.
Well, and I think it was very appropriate that it was the two of them because they build a friendship throughout this movie, but Veronica is in denial of it. Like when Bash dies, she doesn't go to Linda. She goes to Alice.
Mm-hmm.
It was very appropriate at the end that she can finally recognize that this group of women is essential for her to move on.
Mm-hmm.
And that she, in a sense, really needs them yep. to move on.
Yeah, and they can support each other and be a part mm-hmm. of each other's lives, not just help each other out of a financial hole.
Right.
Well, I think that just about covers it. How did you feel about the movie?
It was a very touching movie
mm-hmm.
in a lot of ways. Not all good.
Yeah.
It really makes you reflect.
Yeah.
I'm very glad that I watched it.
I wonder what we're going to watch next.
Oh, we're going to be doing Troop Zero.
Ooh, yay!
I'm really, really excited. I'm so glad that we're doing Viola Davis. And this movie just goes to show why we're covering her. Because she's just so good. So good. Ah, so good.
Well, with that, this has been Two Sisters Present
America's Sweethearts.
Until next time. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.